Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This is episode 60 of our Coppola journey, and if you are new to the podcast, what we do here is we watch every single film in the Coppola Family Collective filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? I don't do that alone, however, I'm joined by a guest, and today's guest is an absolute doozy. It's a return guest. It is the one, the only, James King. More on him very shortly. And the film we are discussing this week is Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. If you've not seen this film, we get into spoilers off the bat. We kind of really, we spoil this film. The film itself spoils elements of the film. We kind of skirt around things, but we get into a lot of fun topics here as well. We get into some talk of nepotism, James's encounters with the Coppola families, a lot of fun stuff. If you haven't seen this film or haven't seen it in a while, I would really recommend a fantastic 4K and Blu-ray that has just been released by Studio Canal. I was lucky enough to be gifted a copy, and it is a beautiful transfer that just looks stunning. It really does this film justice. You may notice at the end of this conversation that James's audio went a bit squiffy. We talk about electro artists in this episode where we talk about French duos. James very much does an impression of Daft Punk here. And that is no fault of his own. That is fault of Zoom. Zoom and the internet was bugging out a bit, so there are slight technical issues, but it doesn't really detract from the main body of the episode. It's kind of in the roundup and the final questions, so but you get the gist of it anyway, so yeah, just watch out for that. So with all of that out of the way, I guess that all that's left to do is to drape over your sisters whilst listening to records, round up your mates and grab your telescope and spy on the neighbourhood girls. Be a heartthrob at your local high school and invite said girls to the homecoming dance as we make some Coppola connections with The Virgin Suicides. On this episode, we're putting on our summer dresses. We're looking longingly as we sit in a picturesque field, and we'll thumb through some diaries of the Lisbon sisters as we discuss the 1999 suburban drama Virgin Suicides. Based on the novel of the same name by Geoffrey Eugenides, the film stars Kirsten Dunst, Hannah Hall, AJ Cook, Leslie Heyman, and Chell Swain as the Lisbon sisters, Kathleen Turner and James Wood as their parents, Josh Hartnett, Robert Schwartzman, Lee Kagan, Noah Shabib, Jonathan Tucker and Hayden Christensen, some of the neighbourhood boys and their classmates. The film is written and directed by this episode's Coppola Connection with her big screen debut, Sofia Coppola. to help me navigate the tumultuous teen years and help me determine if the Coplas are the greatest film family of all time is a man who's written the book on teen movies, Hollywood hairdos and Keanu Reeves, as well as being BBC Radio 2's film critic, a presenter, a broadcaster, a podcaster, and as it's his second time on the podcast, I'd like to say a friend of the pod, James King. How are you, James?
Well, I'd forgotten I'd written a book about Hollywood hairdos, so thank you for reminding me of that. good, thank you. And this is a really special movie to me, actually, The Virgin Suicides. Mm. I sort of even remember seeing it for the first time and where I was and everything like that. So looking forward to talking about it. And it's something that's sort of been with me ever since it came out and holds a special place in my heart. So out of all the ones, and I mean, dare I even say more than The Godfather and things like that, Apocalypse Now, I think out of all the Coppola movies and the Coppola family movies, maybe this one is my ultimate one.
Well, I was thinking, what was really a fascinating thing of the two films you've come on the podcast to talk about? Last time you came on to talk about The Outsiders, and this time The Virgin Suicides, which kind of feel like, I don't know, like two sides of the same coin of kind of both looking at like, teenager, and both kind of retrospectives to 20 years past as well. Obviously, The Outsiders was the 1950s from, or like the 1980s, like this kind of the 30 years. And then you've got, The Virgin Suicides, which is the 1970s. And it's kind of almost like Sofia Coppola was kind of like using the Francis Ford Coppola playbook of being like, let's take a book, but let's do something for teenage girls that my dad did essentially for teenage boys in the 1980s. And we'll get into all of that. But before we do, I wanted to ask you, James, when did you first become aware of Sofia Coppola as a kind of, well, I guess it might have been first as an actress.
Yeah, it was. I remember reading Empire magazine when Godfather Part 3 came out. And that was when I read about all, these are pre-internet days, so read about all the problems with making that movie, Winona Ryder pulling out, and Sofia coming in, and the really critical reviews of her performance. And I don't think I saw Part 3 at that point. Maybe I was put off by the bad reviews, actually, around Sophia's acting. But that was when I first came to know her. And you sort of felt, just the way it was pitched, and me being a kid, really, when that came out, so I didn't know any better, I just thought, okay, this is a rich, privileged girl, you know, doing her thing or trying to do her thing, and it didn't work, and that will probably be the last we hear of her, because what does she need to work for, really? And then, of course, many years later, it felt like many years, but actually it's not that many years, really. It's what, like seven, 8 years later?
Yeah.
Then along comes The Virgin Suicides. I hadn't seen her short film Lick the Star before that, but along comes The Virgin Suicides. I think I saw it at the London Film Festival, so it had a bit of prestige to it because it was showing at a major film festival. And she completely changed my opinion of her, and the same way, I think, with a lot of people. She moved on from being the girl who'd been not very good in The Godfather Part 3 to being actually a really exciting, new, young, fresh director, writer-director.
I think that whole thing with The Godfather Part 3 really kind of shook her to her core, because it's only yesterday a TikTok from her own daughter kind of like has gone viral, and like her talking about how her mum doesn't like her to have social media. And I think like any interviews with Sofia Coppola, she's very cagey when it comes to talking about her family. And it's kind of like, it's like that experience was like, no way am I pushing my kids into that world. Cause yeah, it feels, I don't know, there's, you can see Frances had the right intentions and was obviously in a bind, but like, I don't know, it feels like, yeah, it's kind of, it's come back. I think, yeah, I think stuff like that has like come back in her career. I think like a film like Somewhere, another Sofia film, is very much a film her going, hey, like it wasn't all peaches and cream with my dad. Do you know what I mean? Like I've used the avatar of a Hollywood like actor, but like it was tough growing up, as tough as it can be to have all this excess and wealth. But also she had a dad who essentially has a gambling problem when it comes to making movies. Do you know what I mean? He'll put the house on the line, as we're seeing at the moment with Megaropolis. He's kind of like put the vineyards on the line to self-fund the movie. So like...
Yeah, nice use of the word cagey, by the way. But yeah, I totally agree. And it's because of the way journalism was when The Godfather 3 came out, and you're sort of quite limited, really, in terms of how you can pick up on news. This, you know, in the early 90s, like I said, I learned about it all from Empire magazine. You maybe don't hear both sides of the story, and I think maybe Sophia didn't even give her side of the story at that point. But since then, has talked about it, and we have found a bit more about it. Like you said, found out that her unhappiness at the whole thing as well, and she wasn't just being some privileged teenager going, please daddy, put me in your movie. And I think she's been very honest about it, and yeah, their childhood sounds fascinating. I remember interviewing Roman, her brother, once, and he was telling me about being on the set of Apocalypse Now and all this kind of stuff, and just like being in the back of a, you know, Land Rover or something as they're driving around the Philippines, you know. Yeah. And it's like, wow, my God, I was brought up in like a village in Suffolk, you know, and this dude's on the set of Apocalypse Now. Yeah. So it, on the one hand, that sounds really exciting, but, you know, sometimes children also crave some kind of order in their life. And that's clearly something they didn't have as much of. And I do think that her fascination with being a teenage girl, as in Virgin Suicides, or just young women, you know, a lot of young female characters and characters growing up, adolescent characters, I think she's covered that ground a lot. And that is clearly something that's very close to her heart. Mm-hmm. In terms of thematic, in terms of just revisiting and maybe working through some of her own issues from her own teenage years. Boredom, she does really well. That sort of feeling of being slightly trapped by, I mean, the Lisbon sisters in The Virgin Suicides, and it's not like they're rich, but at the same time, they're absolutely middle class. Their dad's a teacher. They've got a relatively nice house and, you know, relatively comfortable and well off. Of course, Marie Antoinette is a princess. But all these characters, they feel trapped. And so you certainly get the sense that some of that probably is what Sophia felt as well. Growing up rich with a father who had high highs and low lows. And she's probably felt quite trapped by that at points.
And there's obviously a kickback as well. Because if you mentioned her brother Roman. I think she said in interviews, there's a great special feature on the new 4K of this released by Studio Canal. That it's like revisiting this, and she said, like, growing up, she was just surrounded by men and boys. Do you know what I mean? Is it all her cousins? Do you know what I mean? You've got Nicolas Cage and like the Schwartzman brothers and stuff like that. It's all this kind of masculine energy. Do you know what I mean? She even says, like, I've got an Italian dad, like, it's a lot of this testosterone. And it's kind of fascinating that her career is almost like a kickback on that, of like, let's make it, do you know what I mean? It's pastel pink. Like, you look at the spine for Marie Antoinette. I think the DVD case itself is like neon pink and stuff like that. And it's really fascinating. And it's and we'll get into it with this film. Like, I just think it's great, especially coming from a place of privilege, how she captures that boredom and kind of like a world that you would imagine she would have no experience of at all, this kind of suburbia. Before we get to really diving into this film, James, I must ask you, obviously you mentioned interviewing Roman there. How many Coppolas have you interviewed? You're a man about town, so yeah, how many have you checked off the list?
How many Coppolas? Yeah, well, Sophia, Nick Cage, Jason Schwartzman. Who are some of the outliers I might be forgetting? I almost said Wes Anderson, but he's not. He's just...
he's an honorary.
World.
Yeah, I think he would definitely, like, Thanksgiving might get an honorary invite. I think he was at a party at Francis's house when... And that's how he met Jason Schwartzman, or, like, was right. Like, yeah, that, who's this precocious young man? He must be in my next film. And then before we know it, like, it seems like him and Roman have got like story by credits just by default now on all of his films. So like
Spike Jones, when he was with Sophia, interviewed Spike Jones. I mean, this is a little bit tenuous now, but you know, he was part of the gang for a while. I think Francis called him like the future of cinema or something. So he got the blessing from his almost father-in-law.
I've said it on this podcast that there's almost no Spike Jones as we know him without Francis Ford Coppola kind of pushing people. I think it was John Malkovich. He said, you must read this script for being John Malkovich. And like, I think Francis was offered the script originally. He went, I can't direct this, but I know a young whippersnapper who can. And then it's kind of like, boom, we get Spike Jones.
It'd be amazing if Francis had been offered Jackass as well. I love the fact that Spike also produces and is heavily involved with the Jackass movies, because that maybe that was the thing that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. It's like, Spike, you know, you're a brilliantly talented movie maker. You've done Being John Malkovich and adaptation and all this stuff. Why do the Jackass movies? Mm. You know, please. And the Coppolas are a bit like, yeah, we don't want this dude who does the Jackass movies in our life anymore.
But he treats a penis dressed up as a kaiju like it is high cinema, James. So you've got to hats off to the man.
I think there's something kind of avant-garde and modern art about the Jackass movies. I'm on his side, but it was always the thing that sort of looks a bit out of place on his CV, wasn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, going back to the Coppolas, he was when I first interviewed him, he was absolutely part of that crowd then. And Jason, actually, I interviewed Jason. It wasn't even for a film. It was when he was in the band Phantom Planet.
Amazing.
Obviously, we chatted about acting and things like that, but it was also a musical interview, because he was drummer, wasn't he, for Phantom Planet?
Yeah, he's. I think he's the co-writer of their big hit, California, as many people
may know. What a song.
Yeah, I repurposed that when I did a mini series called Schwartzman Summer and just changed it from California to Jason Schwartzman. And it's
So I think that's the Coppolas. I'm concerned I missed out some, that I don't think so. So no, I think that's probably the lot.
So what is it you interviewed Sophia Coppola for? Was it a kind of like,
oh yeah, number of things when she has a new film out, definitely. Definitely interviewed her around Marie Antoinette, because I did an on-stage interview with her, and this was at a cinema in Leicester Square in London, the View Cinema, Leicester Square, and it was, let's say, 8 o'clock at night. And before that, it was the same week that Nick Cage's version of The Wicker Man came out.
Oh boy.
And that wasn't screened to the press for obvious reasons. So I wanted to see it, and I loved the original Wicker Man. So I paid to go and see the new version of the Wicker Man in the afternoon at the Empire Leicester Square. That ended, and then I walked like 100 meters across Leicester Square to the View Leicester Square, where Sophia was waiting to go on and do this on stage. And I said, I've just seen your cousin in a movie, The Wicker Man. And I mean, what did I expect her to say? I don't know. It's not like we then immediately bonded and had a great discussion about Nick Cage. Maybe that's what I wanted. Maybe that's what you would have wanted, right? You know, just to have this great bonding moment discussing Nick Cage's filmography. That didn't happen. But I'd always remember that on the same day, I did two Coppolas, Nick in The Wicker Man, and then an onstage with Sophia.
Amazing. Were you aware beforehand that that was the case, or was it kind of as you were walking to do the on stage with Sophia, you're like, oh yeah, shit, I've done this weird double bill?
Yeah, no, I was aware. It seemed too neat not to go through with it. I felt like this is kismet or something. I have to do this. And I do remember talking to Nick Cage, when he had a film out called Wind Talkers with John Woo, the director, and he was paired with John Woo. And I remember talking to Nick Cage in the interview about, I can't remember actually whether it was Sophia or Jason, but John Woo was like, who are you talking about? And Nick was like, oh, it's my cousin. And I thought, oh my God, this is so cool. It's like, yeah, they're my cousin. You know, I love this family. And yeah, I think Cage has been, publicizing a few things. I definitely interviewed him around the time of Knowing. And Sophia, yeah, probably for her movies after Marie Antoinette as well, maybe Somewhere, I can't remember. But she's great. You know, I'm very chilled, and I love talking to her about music, you know, the music, the soundtracks that she's worked on, and have been so important to those movies. And I actually had a bit of a fanboy moment. I did some work recently on a documentary called Fire of Love, which was actually Oscar nominated and is on Disney Plus. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. I don't know if you've seen it. Have you?
Not yet. No, it's on the list.
So good. But anyway, the score to Fire of Love is by Nick from the band Air. Mm-hmm. And Air also did the score to Virgin Suicide. And some of it is new music, but some of it is repurposed. And so there's bits from the Virgin Suicide score in Fire of Love. And so I did an on-stage interview with the director and the producer of that movie. Shane's the producer and Sarah's the director. And just had a fanboy bonding moment about how much we loved Air and their music and the Virgin Suicide score and all that kind of thing. And actually, Fire of Love has a not dissimilar voiceover and a narrator. It's a female narrator, an actress called Miranda July, doing the narration. But re-watching the Virgin Suicides and listening to Giovanni Ribisi's narration, and then the use of the music by Air, and then watching Fire of Love, this documentary about two volcano experts from the 70s, but hearing that narration and the music by Air in that film, I watched and I thought, they have to be Virgin Suicides fans. Yes. The people who made this movie are definitely Virgin Suicides fans.
I love that now she swapped out Air for Phoenix, because I imagine she gets a cheaper rate because it's her husband's band. Like, it's a similar vibe. They're French.
Yeah,
like,
it works. She loves a hipster French band, that's for sure.
Amazing. Well, let's talk about The Virgin Suicide.
All to understand those five girls who, after all these years, we can't get out of our minds. They were girls, but only that we had loved them.
This film was made on a budget of $6.1 million. 61, Jesus Christ, if only. And made a box office return of $10.4 million. It premiered at Cannes on the 19th of May, 1999. James, can you tell us what The Virgin Suicides is all about?
Yeah, well, it's based on a novel by Geoffrey Eugenides. I may have pronounced his name wrong. And it's about five sisters, the Lisbon sisters. This is in suburban America in the 70s, mid to late 70s. And one of them clearly has mental health issues and commits suicide. And it's about how that affects the rest of the family, the aftermath of that, how the parents react, how the other sisters react, but also how the neighborhood reacts as well, really. And a lot of the film is from the point of view of her male, the family's male neighbors, so the boys who are of the same age as the Lisbon sisters, who live nearby, who go to the same school, and how they kind of talk about it and discuss it, and are all really in love with the Lisbon sisters. They have this sort of air of mystery about them, I guess, because it's a slightly unusual family. On the one hand, it's a very normal family because it's suburban and the dad's a teacher and they live sort of a normal life, but then the mum clearly has a few issues. She's quite strict. She's very religious. The dad, obviously, understandably, after the loss of one daughter, starts to behave a little eccentrically. So they kind of morph from being, on the face of it, quite a regular, everyday suburban family to being a bit more peculiar and a bit more unusual. And they won't let the remaining daughters out of the house. And so, a lot of it is seen from the point of view of the boys who live nearby, who spy on them through their telescope.
Yeah.
And who are all fascinated by them.
And there's, as you mentioned earlier, there's that great kind of Giovanni Ribisi narration from it. You can only, it's never revealed who he is of the kids, is it? Of the boys. It's kind of like, there's,
I think officially it's meant to be, is it Weiner? I can't remember. There is an official answer to that, but it's only by reading about it online. You don't actually get to know that from watching the film.
Yeah.
The voiceover is an adult version of one of the boys looking back. And so there is also that feeling of nostalgia about the film too. It is definitely a looking back, a remembering kind of film. And what I like about that nostalgia is that on the one hand, it's, remember being a 13, 14-year-old boy and falling in love and listening to the music of the time, and everything seems kind of sunny and beautifully lit. And so it has that nostalgic glow about it. But then at the same time, obviously, it's about this family who have real problems, and there's suicide in it, as the title kind of suggests. So there is a real darkness to it as well. It's not all happy, retro comfort viewing. It's dark, but I think it blends the two really well. It's certainly, when I rewatched it for this, it's certainly funnier than I remembered.
Yeah.
And I think the way it blends the funny moments with the really sad, tragic moments is incredibly clever and subtle and expertly done.
Well, on this rewatch, I'd kind of forgotten how upfront they are that all five sisters are doomed. It's kind of like you learn that in like maybe like the first 20 minutes that they're all bound for an early grave, and it's like.
I guess the title kind of tells you that.
But you know, the virgin suicide. You do see Lux. So like maybe one would get away. It does this really clever thing with that like there is these fun moments and you do see them like enjoying themselves, but then you also just have this like creeping cold hand on the back of your neck that like you know that you like at any moment you're kind of like when, like a slasher movie in a weird way, it's like when are we getting the next kill in a way, do you know what I mean? When are we getting, and like what is it going, how is it going to happen? And I'd watched this years ago and kind of like forgotten like how it kind of the climax of it, and was just like kind of awestruck.
There's this sense that the girls know, obviously they're almost planning what's going to happen, but the boys can never quite get into their heads, into the girls' heads, can never quite get close enough to them to sort of work that out. Mm-hmm. And by the time the film ends and you sort of sat there thinking about it, you go, well, did they plan this all along? Had the girls known about this? Had the girls always sort of agreed to do this? But we're never privy to those moments, to those conversations. So you never quite know. And that, so it's, they still retain that air of mystery, which is why we presume there is an adult version of one of these boys looking back on this story. It still confuses him. He's still in the dark about exactly what happened. I think the best moment for me of that mix of funny comedy, but then it kind of goes dark, is there's a party scene. So the girls have been recommended just to mingle more with other people.
Yeah, by Danny DeVito.
By Danny DeVito, who's brilliant, isn't it? And so the parents reluctantly say, okay, we'll invite some local boys round and you can just mingle more. It'll be good for you to do that. And it's very funny because it's all really awkward, and it's that classic kind of 13, 14-year-old, maybe it's not like that now, but it was when I was a kid. It's awkward, boys and girls not really knowing what to say to each other. They're all in the basement just being really awkward. And it's funny. And then one of the daughters, is it Cassie? Connie? I can't remember what's her name.
I've got the names listed here. It is Hannah Hall's character. So that is Cecilia.
Cecilia, I knew it was a C, right. So then one of the daughters, Cecilia, who is the one who we first see with mental health problems, she just goes upstairs. She says, I've had enough. I'm going upstairs. And you kind of go, all right. And then you hear this scream. And then it becomes something completely different. It becomes what's happened, why has she done this, and the boys discovering her suicide, the family discovering her suicide, which is awful because it's her throwing herself out of the window and landing on the fence, the iron fence outside, sort of skewered by this fence. I mean, it's hideous. And you just think, wow, 30 seconds ago, this was quite a comedic little party about kids having a party and being really awkward with each other. And just like that, it's flipped into a moment of tragedy. And that blend, it's not an easy blend to pull off, because a lot of the time critics would go, well, this tone is all over the place. You know, is this one thing? Is this another film? But actually, The Virgin Suicides blends the two really well. I think because of what you said, I think even in those funny moments, there's still that sense, because we have been told that bad stuff is going to happen. So even in the funny moments, the stuff with Trip Fontaine, played by Josh Hartnett, it's funny, you're laughing, there's some good gags, but you still think, yeah, but I'm sure at the beginning of this movie, we were told that all of these girls are going to be dead.
Yeah.
So you're just waiting for the bad shit to happen.
Yeah, it's like when you have that moment, like when they get invited into the house at the end, where you get that great montage of them playing records to each other over the phone. And then the boys like sneak over, like they get invited over and like, yeah, come on in. I'll go out to the car. And then we just get a flash to like the boys' imagination of what it could be. And they're
heartbreaking,
like driving in the car during the day. And then we kind of get the like 1, 2, 3, 4 punch of that. All four sisters have just kind of met. Like
that stuff, those dreams the boys have, if you like, imagining taking the girls out, taking the girls away, getting them in the car and having the breeze blowing through their hair and the sunshine. I think those moments, I mean, actually, it does kind of happen in the film, because there's a moment where a load of boys take them out to the homecoming dance. Mm. And those moments where the girls escape from their house, they are allowed to go outside, to mingle, to get in a car and drive away. I think those brief moments of freedom that they have, whether they're real, like at the homecoming dance, or whether the boys are imagining them, hoping that they're going to happen, they're really powerful. And that idea of the girls being trapped in this home, actually, even when they're not officially trapped, when in theory they are still allowed to go out, it's still a really claustrophobic house. It's still quite a sterile house, isn't it? So there's a lovely lovely clash, really, between the girls at home being bored, feeling trapped, and those brief moments when they're allowed space, when they're allowed to get out. I love that shot of Lux, Kirsten Dunst, after she's made out with Trip Fontaine, and she wakes up on the football pitch the next morning, and it's like it's just her on her own, surrounded by space. And it's not a particularly great moment because her boyfriend's run off, but at the same time she just feels like someone who finally can be outside and in some space rather than trapped in this suburban house.
Even that moment like has some darkness to it, because we hear this like, and there's that really interesting use that we get the adult Trip Fontaine, which is it's like a kind of like curveball out of nowhere, because we don't get that in with any other character. And that's
And it's sort of shot in a way, it's like, you know, The Office or something, isn't it? It's like a documentary. Yeah,
it reminded me of True Detective, you know, when we're getting like the interviews with Matthew McConaughey's character like across the table, and then there's almost like the twist in that as well, that he's in some kind of like facility. Do you know what I mean? And it's like,
He's clearly has addiction issues or something, and has to go off to have his 6 o'clock meeting. So there's that suggestion, and Trip, the adult Trip, kind of explains this, that, you know, he's never been that in love since. Mm. He's felt that kind of emotion since
when he handles high school. He handles it terribly, because I kind of read into this. It's written on Wikipedia, so it's not the trusted source, but it says that they have sex that night. So like it is like that kind of what we get in loads of teen movies, supposed to be that like great night. And like the way that it's shot with the kind of like the blue hue over that like when she wakes up in the morning, just, and of all things it reminded me of is when, you'll know this well as a Keanu Reeves fan, is in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey when they are dead and like everything has kind of got that blue hue. And it has like a kind of very haunting element to it. As much as she is free, it's like this thing of like, it's all going to close in because we know what's going to happen. Like we've established who her parents are, that, and the way that's handled when she goes back, like I think a lesser filmmaker, we would have had this like screaming match and stuff like that. Yes. All we get is just that shot of her kind of like a forceful arm, like kind of pulling her into the house. And like, what, like we get a shout, but it's not like, it's far away and it's kind of distant. And I love those details that,
Sophia does. It avoids a lot of those big confrontational scenes that could, I'm sure they could be powerful. They're all great actors, you know, seeing James Woods do shouting is always fun. But not that his character in this is so much of a shouter, really. It's more Kathleen Turner's mother character. But at the same time, I'm glad they didn't do that. I know exactly that scene you're talking about. And I had exactly those feelings watching it again after a few years of not seeing it. I couldn't remember exactly what happened. And I was sat there going, I hope we don't now cut in to the interior of the house and see Kathleen Turner have this long slanging match with Kirsten Dunst. I hope it just ends there. And it does. They just Sofia Coppola just leaves it to your imagination. And again, it sort of goes back to what I said about the boys still not knowing so much. It was all that shot of Lux arriving home after her night of passion on the football field and her parents have been wondering where she is and she gets dragged inside the house. It's almost like you're watching it from the house over the road. Mm. You're one of the boys spying on her, obsessed with her. And then as soon as she goes inside the house, you don't know what happens anymore.
Yeah.
And they're really constructing the whole story just from what they know, but they don't know everything because they couldn't have witnessed everything.
The narrative of the film is almost like told through like hearsay and whispers.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it. And what I noticed, and it might have been because I watched this quite recently, but the way she portrays suburbia at the beginning and the kind of like, I don't know, the oddness of it. And we kind of see like all of the weird characters of the neighborhood and all the people gossiping and stuff like that. It really reminded me of Edward Scissorhands and the way that Tim Burton treats suburbia as this like, as the weird place it is. Do you know what I mean? Everybody's in on everyone's business. Do you know what I mean? And I imagine it's something that would have been fascinating for Sofia Coppola being, do you know what I mean? She grew up on an estate in Napa. So like it's probably, she's got the ultimate outsider's perspective of like these rows of houses and everybody being on top of each other and knowing everybody's business. And I guess she probably has a different, almost like pumping in a bit of the celebrity thing as well. Like a lot of people know about her business from a young age and stuff like that. And I imagine a lot of her life would have been told through hearsay and whispers and stuff like that. And as you said, like
I think it's often good when a filmmaker tells a story that they are outside of, because they see it from a different perspective. Now, that's not to say that if you are totally involved in a story, if it is your story you're telling, that's also incredibly powerful. But sometimes it's like when you get, let's say, a filmmaker who isn't from the States going to the States and making an American movie, maybe with some real social impact to it. And you get a sort of outsider's view. And there's something really interesting, I think. It's like maybe like when Ang Lee made Brokeback Mountain, you know, this is not the obvious guy to make that movie. But he, just because he comes from a very different culture, it brings something to it. I think her outsider status as rich, privileged daughter of an Oscar-winning filmmaker, making a film about suburbia, also brings a new slant to things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I must ask you, James, you said you can remember the first time you saw this film. Well, who were you at that point? Like, who was James King in 1999 or 2000 when you saw this film?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was London Film Festival. You know, I apologise if I'm wrong, but it was definitely a Leicester Square screening in London. And there wasn't a huge amount of hype, I don't feel, about this film. I'd probably heard a bit about it, but because of who directed it. But it wasn't like the film that everyone's talking about. But I was hugely moved by it. And also I was fascinated at that time with Kirsten Dunst and Josh Hartnett, who were two of the biggest teen stars of that era and who I'd seen in other things and who were in, you know, iconic teen movies around that time and were really seen as sort of the future of Hollywood at that time. So it was great to see them in something that I felt wasn't like, as much as I love The Faculty or Get Over It or whatever, you know, there are their kind of teen movies. This actually was something very different tonally, had a much different mood to it. And yeah, I just remember coming out of the screening and being almost hypnotized by it. I think it has a hypnotic quality. Yeah. The music certainly helps with that, but there's also a kind of slowness about it that definitely didn't feel cool at that point. It certainly wasn't like the fashion to be like that, but there's a slowness about it. You hear like ticking clocks in the background quite a lot and just that sort of hum of traffic in the background. It almost has like a heartbeat to it, this film, of just the slowness of suburbia, just life slowly ticking along. It's what sent the girls, you know, to their grave, unfortunately, because they just couldn't take it anymore. And I definitely remember being mesmerized, hypnotized by that, the pace of the film and the way that the music lulls you into that world.
And I think it's a really interesting way of using, like, this could have been like Needle Drop Central of just 70s hits. And it's got a few like 70s numbers like dropped in and stuff like that throughout it.
They're all part of the story though, aren't they?
Yeah, but the use of the Air soundtrack, and I think there's some other like kind of more like 90s and like 80s Needle Drops, I think adds to that element of it being a memory. Do you know what I mean? Like you almost, oh yeah, was that song out at that time? You kind of remember, you don't really remember what was playing at that time, and but like somehow like music gets attached to it. Maybe it was, I don't know, something that came out afterwards, but it was a time when you were processing what happened then and you kind of like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you attach it to it. And I think the use of the air music is fantastic.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, I'd never heard a soundtrack like that before. I don't think, there must have been other soundtracks you could compare it to, I guess. But even so, that you had this very hip French electronic duo doing a whole soundtrack. And I knew them from Sexy Boy and, you know, that Moon Safari album, which is amazing. I think actually one of the tracks from Moon Safari is used on the Virgin Suicides. But so they were very cool at that point. So when I said I hadn't heard a lot about the film, I'd probably heard more about the soundtrack actually than I had about the actual film. And the song Playground Love, you know, I was working at Radio 1 at the time. We definitely played that. So the soundtrack was a cool thing, and it was a different thing. And again, comparing it to other teen movies of the time, which were all about big pop soundtracks, this had something much more laid back and something much more eerie, really. I think Playground Love is an incredibly eerie song. It's a romantic song, but it's really eerie. Really bleak, beautifully bleak.
Yeah, the whole soundtrack's kind of got like a creepiness to it. And it's like,
yeah. And actually, even the Needle Drops, even when they use the retro songs, I love the way they use Strange Magic, the Electric Light Orchestra song. That whole Homecoming Dance part of the film, it is almost magical, actually, because they're allowed to go out, they're finally allowed to be themselves and to have the experiences of regular teenagers. And the way it's shot, it's almost like it would be a magical moment for those girls, a magical moment for the boys as well. It's one of those things that, yeah, as adults, we look back on and go, wow, do you remember that magical night when I was 14 and we went to that party and, you know, I snogged that person and it was all beautiful and amazing. And it really captures that magic so well. But Strange Magic is a song. That's also kind of ethereal. So even the old songs have that ethereal, dreamy quality about them.
Yeah. I love that aspect of it. There's so much I love about it. And I know that, like, Sofia Coppola, like, when talking about the film, obviously as a first-time director, she said, like, the people involved, so the cinematographer especially, what was his name? Edward Lachman was, like, she said, was so helpful to kind of help her with her vision and kind of like took her under his wing because, yeah, as much as she's come from the family she's come from, like this was a new thing. And I guess a question I wanted to talk about with that is like, how much of this, I mean, obviously like nepotism is a big thing people like to talk about. It's like, and I think it's something we can't shy away with this. It's like, does this film get made? Because like, it's kind of crazy, like the story behind this with what Sophia being given the book by Thurston Moore of all people from Sonic Youth. But like, yeah, read this, like that. Okay, that doesn't happen to, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like normally, oh, my mate Dave lent me a book or something. Like, just Thurston Moore, and then the film was going to get made by a studio, a script had been written, and like Sophia was kind of heartbroken having read the book and was like, I'm just going to try and write a script. And like, kind of, I think she said, I thought I'd do a few pages before I knew it. I'd literally done the whole movie. And she'd remembered her dad talking about how you adapt a novel. And I think he's famously, like, The Godfather Notebook's been talked about, how he kind of just took the novel itself and kind of, yeah, like, stuck the pages down, highlighted stuff, we'll use that, and then kind of turned it into a script and stuff like that. But, yeah, how much of this happens because of Francis? Like,
I think a lot of it. He produced it, right? It's an American Zoetrope production, and there are people... Clearly, you've worked with Kathleen Turner before, and people like James Woods and Danny. Well, you've worked with Danny DeVito before, you know. So you get the sense, of course, that his fingerprints are all over it. Gordon Willis, I think, works on it as well, you know. So there are. You can't shy away from the fact that he had a huge influence on it.
Yeah.
And again, going back to how I remember the movie. Maybe that was another thing I thought. Maybe I thought about the Air soundtrack. Maybe I thought about The Godfather Part 3. And maybe I also thought, well, this will be rubbish. It's just Francis giving his daughter a gig. You know, she only got this because of who she is. So maybe I also went in with those thoughts as well. I certainly didn't come out with those thoughts, but I probably went into the movie thinking that this was just nepotism. But you know, we cannot avoid that. It's I'm sure it would, if she was, you know, Sophia Jones with no movie connections whatsoever, Sophia Smith, then she wouldn't have got to make the movie. But she proved herself. That's the key thing.
There are
lots of people who've got to places because of nepotism and they've just been rubbish. And you go, well, they're rubbish, but they're doing really well because of their surname. Mm-hmm. But Sophia is doing really well now because she's a really good filmmaker.
Yes.
And maybe the initial leg up was because of her surname, but she certainly proved herself over and over again. I don't think we can sort of now say, oh, well, she's only where she is because she's a Coppola. Arguably, currently, she's the most successful Coppola filmmaker out there. Sorry, Francis, but you know, his track record of late has been patchy. But Sophia keeps coming out with stuff and not blockbusters. That's not really her style. But at the same time, consistently good reviews and consistently critically acclaimed.
Well, it's great to see. It's easy for people to forget that she said in an interview that she was like only in her late 20s when she made this movie. So like, she kind of was like, I'm not that far away from these girls, really. Like, that's not a distant memory for me. It's quite fresh. And it's really great to kind of see some of the footage and like stills of her on set and the way she ran the set, which is something like anyone I've ever heard speak about her sets are just kind of really serene, really, really quiet and really like, yeah, the girls in this, I think the family basically ate meals together. Like, they kind of got to know each other, and the child labor laws, that like they were kind of like, no, we want to work more. Like, this is like a 30-day yeah. shoot or something like that. And obviously, yeah, you've got Kirsten Dunst and like Hannah Hall and stuff like that, who are like, no, but we're having so much fun making this movie. We've almost become
that
a family.
That actually sounds a bit like The Outsiders again.
Yes.
Because there was definitely that atmosphere with Francis cooking on the set of The Outsiders, and just that him wanting to create this mood on set of yeah, I mean, I know some of the characters in that movie, in The Outsiders, he sort of separated from others to keep the rivalries going even when the camera wasn't rolling. But at the same time, there was that feeling of, we're all in this together and we'll just muck in and we'll get it done, because that was a low budget movie yeah. as well. And I'm sure that's something that Sophia had seen her dad do before and had seen how it worked. And it does work. And the fact that she still works with Kirsten Dunst shows that obviously there's a trust there and there's a mutual respect there.
And she said, like Kirsten Dunst said about this film, that like the thing that really drew her to it initially was, she said it was a script that really like spoke to who she was at that time. Like you mentioned earlier about that. Like her being like a teen star. She said all of the stuff she had done was kind of like, it's not really the emotions I'm going through right now. And it's kind of like, because I know that Scarlett Johansson passed on this for Lux, because she was like, this is a bit too much. Like, yeah. So I can only imagine for Kirsten Dunst, like kind of having maybe not like suicidal feelings and stuff like that, but at least processing and being at that time of your life of like, oh, maybe I'm like interested in like seeing boys now and stuff like that, and kind of having my first kiss and stuff like that. Like, it must be like even more like all encompassing and just such a, I think all of the sisters give like these amazing performances, and kind of like they move in this ethereal like pack way, and like it's just mesmerizing,
yeah, the way they
to watch.
Like lounge around on top of each other,
yeah. It's like a Renaissance painting.
And you hear quite a lot about male directors and the way that they direct women who they're clearly in love with. Mm-hmm. and often they actually end up, you know, having a relationship with them. I remember reading about Howard Deutsch when he directed Some Kind of Wonderful, you know, and ended up marrying the lead actress. And you can kind of tell from watching the film that he was clearly in love with her. But the interesting thing about this is, I think Sofia Coppola almost has that element as the eye on those girls is almost like, I am in love with these girls, mm-hmm. especially Lux.
Yeah.
But of course, everyone was in love with Lux. The sisters were probably, you know, loved her, looked up to her because she was the most charismatic of all of them. The boys obviously were totally in love with her. Even older guys, you know, there's that lovely scene where it's a guy sharpening his knife, yeah. And he's just like lusting after her. This is this kind of Lolita type figure. You know, so Lux obviously was a character that everyone was in love with in various ways.
Yeah.
And it seems like Sophia was as well. The way that she shot Kirsten Dunst in that movie is almost like a director filming someone that they're going to end up marrying.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And it, you know, she hasn't done that. When she made The Beguiled with Kirsten Dunst, it's not like she shot her that way then. It was very much for this movie, and it fits in with what this movie is about. But it's a really interesting dynamic, considering that it's a straight female director, the way that she shoots her, and she makes her look I can't imagine Scarlett Johansson doing it, because the way that she makes Kirsten Dunst look is kind of, with the long blonde hair, it's almost nymph-like, fairy-like. There's something, well, like we said, magical about her. And I don't think Scarlett Johansson quite has that quality. Whereas Kirsten Dunst is a more kind of floaty, isn't she?
Yeah, Sophia said there was something about Kirsten Dunst's eyes, like there's
right.
in the way that like she, like her look, she looks optimistic and like, do you know what I mean? She looks like your like blonde hair and stuff like that, but it's something about those eyes. And you see, like, we see it a lot in this film, because there are kind of whole sequences where it's just her in, like, front and center. And there's this kind of like, this despair and like loneliness. And I think like she manages, of all of the actresses who play the sisters, to capture that like look of basically, shit, I'm trapped here. Like,
yeah.
And it's just kind of,
but she's playful as well, isn't she?
Yeah.
Like the way that she leads the boys in the bit, in the big, you know, finale, the big shock moment towards the end of the film. She also has that, talking about the eyes, that glint in the eyes. She's sort of the most cheeky of all of them, mm-hmm. and the most flirtatious of all of them. And it's brilliant, because we're all meant to think, we're all meant to be in love with her. Not, mm-hmm. you know, it's nothing wrong with that. It's like, she's charismatic. She's a charismatic character, and the boys were in love with her, and we're meant to understand why they're in love with her. And I think you totally do, because she's this kind of irresistible character.
100%. I must ask you, James, somebody who's obviously studied teen movies, how do you think this film acts as a teen movie, and like how it subverts the tropes as well? Because there is a kind of a section within the middle of this where it does kind of become an out and out teen movie, especially when we kind of get to that stuff of like, I think it's when Trip Fontaine's introduced, it kind of, the film morphs a bit and like kind of takes us down a different avenue, only to kind of like have everything kind of crashing back down as we get to the climax.
It's certainly sending that up a little bit, isn't it? The idea of the cool guy in school. And I'm sure I remember at the time Josh Hartnett saying, in the same way that Kirsten Dunst said a lot of teen movie scripts were nonsense, this one spoke to me. I remember Josh Hartnett saying, this one was so much more relevant to me. It was because I was being pitched around Hollywood as the cool new hunk. I was being pitched as the Trip Fontaine, but actually I wanted to show people I had something more than that. Mm. And of course we do get that from Trip Fontaine. Things don't work out quite as easily as they would in a more conventional teen movie. So I think he's sending himself up a little bit very early in his career.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a little bit of tongue in cheek there from this Hollywood hunk who people had posters of up on their wall saying, actually, I'm going to send up that whole idea of being a hunk.
Yeah.
And show you that there are more layers to that kind of a character.
He said in an interview that he kind of had that Trip Fontaine moment. And I guess it was that kind of move into Hollywood, because he said, like, at school, he very much was like a bit of an outsider, because he was like a theater kid and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't the jock or anything like that. But like when he kind of moved into Hollywood, he said he kind of became like a poster child and like up on people's walls. It's like, oh, he's had that moment that he's the hot shit, and it's like, and I'm actually like quite a goofy guy and stuff like that. And you kind of like, he really embodies that with Trip Fontaine, who is like, yeah, he's cool and slick, but he's also, I don't know, he's a bit of an idiot.
Well, and at first we think he is just cool and slick, but then the more you learn about him, and then of course with the flash forwards to how he is in the present day, you learn that there's actually a lot more going on, or was a lot more going on with this guy. And I'm always fascinated by how teen movie characters would be when they're adults. That's not to say I want sequels where we actually find out, but I like it to be left up in the air. Mm-hmm. And I think the Virgin Suicides, although, you know, we do find out what happened to Trip Fontaine, it's not, you know, it's only a little bit. And that's what I think is really appealing about it. You go, wow, God, 25 years ago, we'd never have thought that that guy would end up in this situation. Because teen movies tend to end optimistically.
Mm.
And the suggestion that everybody lives happily ever after, well, the Virgin Suicides really punctures that idea. For starters, the five lead girls certainly don't live happily ever after. But even the hunk, the guy who you think had it all, who made life look easy, even he doesn't live happily ever after, yeah. Really. So going back to those sort of tropes of classic teen movies, well, not so much classic teen movies, but mainstream teen movies, it does it doesn't play the game. Mm-hmm. And maybe going back to The Outsiders again, it's a very different film, but you know, it's again, that was another teen movie that had all the elements. It had the stars, it had the eye candy, it had the hot talent of the moment, but it did different things with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that, yeah, like I said, it kind of does do that weird morph into like, yeah, it's taking the girls to the prom, like a movie. And it's yeah. Like, I was kind of like taken aback. It's like, I'd forgotten that Hayden Christensen was in this. I was like, oh yeah, here he is. And I kind of love the young cast in this. Like, I've got to give a massive kind of shout out to Robert Schwartzman as Paul Baldino.
He's
amazing. He has a moment between him and Kathleen Turner that I just don't know how to read. When he asks about the punch, he says, "What's in this?" And she's like, "Pineapple." Yeah. He's like, "I love pineapple," and kind of like looks at her for like a little bit too long. It's like, is there like a frisson of like sexual tension here? Like, what is his end game here?
Well, I think because his parents or his dad is like a gangster in it, isn't he?
Yeah.
That's what we learn. And so I think that's all he kind of knows. He just knows how to be that Italian stallion. And even though he's way too young to be doing it, I guess he's meant to be like 14 or something. He's playing that game, isn't he? He's playing that role. But he's fantastic in it. And even like the, I can't remember whether that's him or is it the exchange kid who throws himself off the roof?
It's the exchange kid, yeah.
Who just walks down the street, like struts like that. And going back to that first screening, watching it, I definitely remember everyone really laughing at that moment.
Yeah.
See this kid like strutting down the road, thinking he's it. And you do think that, you know, at 13 or 14, you're not an adult, but you're getting ideas of how to be one. You're copying things from actual adults. You think, well, I've seen adults look cool because they wear sunglasses the whole time. I've seen adults look cool because they kind of have that walk, like John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. Yeah. And you start to try on those little things and try them out. And you look ridiculous because you're still ultimately a 13-year-old kid, but you just give it a little go. And I think that's exactly what that scene with Kathleen Turner is about. It's about a boy trying out maybe his dad's method, but you know, an adult's method of just being a bit flirty and like, hey ladies, and of course, well, for a start, he's trying it with the wrong person. He's trying it with a very religious, strict mother, but also it just looks silly.
Yeah.
But it's sweet, isn't it? You know, it's sweet.
Yeah, but what I think another moment I have to mention of this film, because I think it really captures something I think that is universal. And like, what is amazing is obviously Sofia Coppola probably, I don't know, she probably does have great insights into the minds of teenage boys, having like grown up with a handful of them. It's that moment when that young guy's invited round for dinner near the beginning.
Yeah.
And we get that sequence of him like going to use the toilet and him kind of like snooping around the bedroom and the bathroom. And it's like, I would be lying if I said like I haven't done that in someone's house. Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of just like that fascination as a teenager, not even like a girl I fancy, just like being round, I don't know, like one of my mum's friends' houses and just kind of like, what is that? Do you know what I mean? How do other people live? It just captures, it just captures that. And I think like,
It's how other people live, and it's also how boys think about girls.
Yes.
Now, I'm not, I mean, I don't have connections with kind of 13 or 14 year olds now. I don't know if it's different now, but, and I was also, you know, my era isn't the era from the Virgin Suicides, it's later. But at the same time, I recognize in those moments the awkwardness of boys around girls and girls around boys. I don't know if it's still like that. I suspect it probably is, but it certainly was in my time. And that, and it is a fascination. And all the boys have it, not just that boy who goes round on his own for dinner, but all the local boys. They're fascinated by these girls. I think they talk about the something like the they're fascinated by the imprisonment of being a girl, which is an amazing line. You know, what it means to be a girl, what goes on when you are a 13, 14, 15-year-old girl. They're fascinated by it. Of course, that kid who goes around for the dinner and then goes up to the bathroom and explores the bathroom, opens up the cupboard and sees like multiple packets of tampons, you know, and he doesn't say anything. It's not a big moment in the film, but I do think it's a moment in the film where he just goes, you can just imagine him thinking, this is so alien to me. I don't even understand what these things are. Or what, you know, what they do. It's a big thing for girls that means zero to me. And that difference between the boys and the girls in it, it captures it so well. And so, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant film about being a teenage girl made by a woman. That's a great thing to have. But it's also a great film about being a teenage boy.
Yeah.
And the second time, sorry, not the second time, the recent time I watched it again, I picked up on that more, I think. I think I always thought of it as a film about being a teenage girl, which it partly is, but it's also really a film about being a teenage boy.
Yeah,
and that is very heavily based on the book. I have read the book, and they are very similar, and to the point of exact lines from the book being in the movie. So you get the sense that sort of the really good things about being a young girl, maybe Sophia injected into the story, but Jeffrey, the author of the novel, could obviously really relate with being a teenage boy.
Well, I think the line that kind of like sums up this film, and it is literally in the first 5 minutes, is when the doctor says to Cecilia, like, why did you try to commit suicide? Like, you don't know what it is like to feel real pain yet. And she answers, obviously, doctor, you've never been a 13-year-old girl. And it's kind of like, that is the mission statement of the movie there, right? It's kind of like, and it's almost like a call to arms to cinema at the time as well. Because Sofia Coppola kind of said, like, artful films about teenage boys had been made and for teenage boys, but nobody had made that for teenage girls. And she almost like felt like a need to do that. And it's kind of like... Yeah. And it's like she's saying to the audience, like, do you know what I mean?
And I think that's another argument against the nepotism, not denying that there was nepotism there. I'm sure there was. But again, what she has achieved, Sofia Coppola, just by being a female filmmaker in Hollywood and having success with her movies and critical acclaim with her movies, that really did change things, and she opened the door for lots of other people. And I don't care whether her dad was Francis Ford Coppola or Joe Bloggs; she did that, and that made a difference.
I'm not going to name names here, but like, I'm sure, unlike other like offspring of famous directors, she could. I'm sure if she said to Paramount, I've got like a modern treatment on like The Godfather, like what would, like, do you know what I mean? Like the kind of offspring of that, and like told through a female lens, and like doing like do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, call it like The Godfather Afterlife or something like that. And like
Godmother.
She, yeah, The Godmother. Yeah, yeah.
Godchildren. Yeah.
Or yeah. But like, she, like, do you know what I mean? She could do that, but she's very much carved out a niche for herself of like,
yeah,
this is what I do. This is what I do. And as we said, like earlier on in the conversation about like how they grew up, I'm sure if you grew up in a bakery, that kind of the flour and the yeast kind of seeps into your skin. And like, if it's a family business, before you know it, you're kneading dough. and you're baking bread and you're taking over the mantle of your parents. And that's not seen as a dirty thing, yet if you grew up on film sets and that's kind of all you know, and you decide to go into that world, that you're kind of, I don't know, a social, this is not me kind of saying all nepotism is good, and saying like sometimes it's inevitable. Like, do you know what I mean? For some people, it is inevitable because of the kind of the upbringing they had. Like, so.
And I think that what's interesting is that Roman is obviously in the film world and makes films, but it's in a slightly different way. It's not always as director, or rarely as actual director. He's more involved in a slightly less kind of conspicuous way, I guess. And, you know, that again, that shows it's not someone doing it for the spotlight. It's not someone doing it for the glory. He's obviously doing it because he's fascinated by the process of filmmaking.
Yes.
If he wanted to do it for the spotlight, he could, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But never went down that route.
Well, yeah, he's a really kind of, I interviewed someone who was in like a string of commercials that he directed. And it's like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, if he wanted the name and recognition, could probably do that. But like, it seems like he's happy kicking about with Wes, spitballing ideas, and like ends up with a story credit for a movie. Then he is kind of, then he is kind of directing his own stuff. He's had two cracks at the whip, like, and that they're varying successes, but he's doing his own thing. Well, this feels like a kind of a nice natural end to our conversation on the Virgin Suicides, James. Is there anything else in the film that you'd like to highlight, actually, before we kind of move on and talk about some connections within the film?
I think it's really lasted well, and there's a new Blu-ray of it coming out. The Blu-ray, if I'm correct, the Criterion version was just in America, mm-hmm. And there's now, it's not Criterion one, but there's a
Studio Canal 4K. Yeah,
there you go, Studio Canal version coming out.
It's out
in
now.
The UK. Oh, even better. Yeah. But what that says to me is that the legacy of the film has lasted, that there's still an interest in it.
Yeah,
and it wasn't necessarily the biggest hit when it came out. You gave the figures when it came out. It wasn't a smash hit, and not everybody liked it. But I do think its reputation has grown, and it's still very much out there. And people like us discussing it now, we're sort of finding how actually impactful it's been since it came out 24 years ago, that actually it did do some new things and open some new doors.
Well, I think in the way that like Rumblefish and The Outsiders for a generation of young boys, like I know that Ethan Hawke like said in a podcast that like even till today he signs off like his cards to his daughter with Stay Gold, and he showed Maya Hawke that film and she went, oh, this is your whole personality. do you know what I mean? Like, this for, I imagine, many, a teenage girl and boy, kind of, maybe more so teenage girls because of the kind of the subject matter. And I imagine a lot of teenage boys would kind of sniff at this film and think, oh, like, do you know what I mean? It's all summer dresses and kind of like what it is to be a girl.
Yeah, it's a bit dreamy and willowy. Yeah,
yeah,
it's not like, Porky's, is it?
Yeah, exactly. But I've got a young son, and I think when he comes of a certain age, I'll be like, you can have your American pies, but also have a Virgin Suicides as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I also know people who are just put off by the title.
Yes.
And actually people who've seen it as well. And it is, you know, it's not everyone's thing. Some people want a teen movie to be Clueless. I'm one of them. I'm more than happy to watch Clueless. But there are some people who go, well, look, when I watch a teen film and I love a teen film, I want it to be Clueless, 10 Things I Hate About You. Something a bit more optimistic, maybe. Well, and this is a different kind of teen film, so it's not everybody's thing. But I'm happy for them, more than happy for them both to coexist. I wouldn't want teen films to only be one style.
Yeah.
But I do know people who think, oh, this is a bit maudlin.
Yeah, and I saw one of the criticisms towards this film was that it doesn't treat the subject matter with the kind of reverence that it deserves. So I guess it kind of like, it falls into this weird place, right? Because it does have fun.
I think that makes it more interesting.
Yes.
I mean, it's hardly treating it lightly for starters, so I can't completely agree with that statement. But also the way that it does treat it, I think that makes it more interesting. It's not wallowing. It's not overplaying it. I think it's much more powerful because it's suggestive rather than being really overdone.
Yes, that's a perfect place to end it, James. But before I let you go, we look for Coppola connections within these films. Is there anyone who is in this film, either in front of or behind the camera, who worked with the Coppolas elsewhere? Does anyone spring to mind?
Well, Kathleen Turner and Peggy Sue got married.
Yes.
I said at the start, Danny DeVito, and I'm trying to think why I said that. I mean, he must have done, right?
The Rainmaker,
there we go, which was around the same time, I think, wasn't it? Not too far off.
96, so yeah, 3 years before.
Was it 3 years earlier? Okay. So there we go. I mean, that you just get the sense that Danny DeVito and Francois Coppola, of course, they've worked together. Yeah, you know, they're very much the same era, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's definitely some of the people behind the camera because it's an American Zotope production, obviously.
Fred Roos, exactly. There.
Yeah. Are there any others?
Well, there's Kirsten Dunst is obviously Marie Antoinette in Marie Antoinette.
Oh yeah. Other Sofia Coppola movies. She makes a little appearance in The Bling Ring as well, playing herself.
Yes, and she's in The Beguiled as well, as we mentioned earlier. And a fun little connection, she is in the Woody Allen short, Oedipus Rex.
Oh, yes.
That is a part of the New York Stories anthology. Which has...
Francis's one is quite bad in that, trilogy. Woody's one is quite good.
Co-written by Sofia Coppola.
Oh, dear, yes. But that was her... I mean, God, she must have been,
a teenage girl. At the time, so we have Leslie Heyman, who plays Therese Lisbon, was a set dresser on Lick the Star.
Star is good, by the way. I watched it on YouTube, so it's available if you've never seen it. Well, you can certainly see a lot of the elements of Virgin Suicides in
there. It's actually included on the... Studio Canal release of Virgin Suicides. Yeah, it's a really great release. I was lucky enough to be sent a copy from them, and it's a new restoration and looks beautiful. It looks stunning. One last one. Giovanni Ribisi is the narrator in this film. Was in Lost in Translation and is Kip Raines in Gone in 60 Seconds alongside Nicolas Cage.
Course. Yeah, I forgot about that.
So, James, let's rate this film. And the way that we do that on this podcast is we talk about what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film. What kind of wine would you suggest pairs well with Virgin Suicides?
I think you'd need something not too mature, and as it is about being young, youthful, and your teenage years, you'd need something maybe quite fruity and sparkling. I'm tempted to say the fruit punch that they actually drink in the movie.
Amazing.
I don't think even the Coppola Vineyards has anything like that.
Amazing. Yeah, I think what would be perfect for this film is a drink that is really famous in South Africa and is a kind of cheat if you ever have a bad wine, is you mix red wine with Coca-Cola. Because I think this film kind of has the darkness of a red wine, but then also has the sweetness of a Coca-Cola, and it very much is the drink of teenagers. It's kind of like an entry-level drink before you start properly boozing. So how much are we paying for this wine, James? Is it top shelf, middle shelf, or bottom shelf? AKA, is the film any good?
I think top shelf would be presumably massive. Would be maybe, you know, Marie Antoinette. That's a bit more sort of a rich, luxurious kind of drink. But I think at this stage, Sophia's very much middle shelf.
Okay. We'll take on that, James. Two final questions for you, James, before I let you go. The first of which being, you've answered this question before, but I'm interested to see if your answer has changed. And it is, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the family?
I am a huge, so it's like my dream to write a book about her movies and they're out there into the world. So, I'm really sorry to Nick, and I'm really sorry to Jason and Carmine and all the others. I think I'd keep Sophia.
That is the same answer you gave last time, James. So you're a man of your word. You're a man of your heart. I love it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is possibly the most important question of this podcast. You can answer this however you like. What does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I'm so glad I knew. I can guarantee it would be underwhelming. It's so much better that it's in our imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can be anything then. And I doubt they ever were told what they were meant to say, or they even have an answer. It's whatever we want it to be. And that's always the most powerful thing, isn't it? Our imagination.
Yeah. I think it was. Don't listen to Seth Green. He's a liar.
Yes, very possibly. I mean, I'm so glad they don't actually answer it. People don't really ask so much now, but they certainly did around the time. Yeah. That was, and I'm so glad there isn't, not that I'm aware of anyway, because it's just the genius of, and some people just don't want this. They don't want open-ended things in films. They want answers to everything. I'm very much more a kind of open-ended person. I love the unknown in films. What happened to the other guys in The Virgin Suicides, the other boy? We don't know what happened to them.
Yeah.
It's unknown. And I love that. The not knowing is really exciting.
Ambiguity is the best. Like, I love it in films. Kind of, I watched Infinity Pool just last night, and that's kind of got like an ambiguous ending. And I was like,
yeah,
love this.
My favorite time.
Before I let you go, James, where's the best place for people to get to keep up to date with everything you're doing?
Instagram, James King Movies on Instagram, on TikTok as well. I think it's James King Movies, I remember. But yeah, Instagram's the main one. So, and I put a lot of interviews and things up there as well. So come and say hi and follow. And hopefully there's some interesting stuff on there for you.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Oh, bless you. Thank you so much. It's so good to see you again. That was so much fun.
A massive thank you to James King for joining me for this episode, as well as a massive thank you to the guys at Studio Canal UK for hooking me up with a couple of fantastic copies to give away in a competition over on Twitter and Instagram, and a copy for myself to see the beautiful 4K restoration of this film, which looks absolutely fantastic. So be sure, if you don't own this on, yeah, it's a great 4K Blu-ray set, so go out and get it. It's packed full with some amazing extras as well, so do yourself a favor, get Virgin Suicided up. Not in the way that sounded really bad, didn't it? I just meant get this Blu-ray 4K in your collection today. And a massive thank you, as always, to you guys for listening. If you feel like me and James missed out anything on this film, or we kind of got it wrong, maybe you feel differently about this film, don't hesitate to get in touch on all the socials. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok, all at CagedInPod. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod at gmail.com. As for the next episode on the podcast, you can join myself and Claire Ellen Hope from the fantastic W-Rated podcast later on this week, where we'll be talking about a fiasco. Not a fiasco, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the feminine, a fiasco involving helicopters, Grammys, and the daughter of Sofia Coppola. So join us then when we kind of run around, figure some stuff out, talk about Sofia's relationship with fame, and how that has transpired into a recent sensation with her daughter. So if you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast and would like to support what we're doing here, you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where as little as like $2 a month, you can help us out. You can give us some cashola. You can put some money in the bank and get some great stuff along with it. Soon to be released is a brand new mini series with myself and Will Chich entitled Ruddy Hell, where we'll be looking at the films of producer Albert S. Ruddy, who famously produced The Godfather. It's got a kind of weird, wonderful and illustrious career in producing. It just felt like a fun kind of tangential way to talk about movies still, but also have it linked to the Coppola family. If you don't want to give us your cash, that is absolutely fine. You can support the podcast by heading over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and leaving a lovely 5-star rating and review. And when writing your review, please be sure to let me know what Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. So, as ever, guys, I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.